I just want to say, to hell with it, and just start a punk rock band again.
Welcome to the show that the fact checkers warned you about. The one that debunks the mainstream narrative and gives you high signal, actionable content that helps you navigate the clown world. It's Bomb Thrower TV with your host, Mark Jeftovic.
Support Geopolitics and Empire. Become a paid subscriber on the Substack. You get a discount if you purchase the annual. You get access to my weekly news brief, and I organize off the record private weekly chats to discuss current events with paid subscribers only. You can donate, purchase a consult, check out all of my affiliates, such as EasyDNS.com, Escape of Technocracy, Wise Wolf Gold, Above Phone, Pass Vault. Leave a podcast review if you haven't already. Why haven't you? Joining us for the very first time here on Geopolitics and Empire is Mark Jeftovic. He's CEO of the Easy Brand group of companies, including Easy DNS, DomainSure, Zone Edit, and Cronly. He also writes at bombthrower.com, and he has a premium service at thecryptocapitalist.com, known as Bitcoin Capitalist. He's also authored a few books, including Unassailable, Protect Yourself from Deplatform Attacks, Cancel Culture, and Other Online Disasters, as well as The Crypto Capitalist Manifesto, The Great Reset is a Monetary Regime Change. Welcome, finally, to the podcast, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me, Hervoy. It's been too long since we've spoke, and I know we've been trying to get this going for a while, and glad we finally connected. So, I mean, we've talked before, but not on this show.
Yeah. We've chatted a few times on my old TNT radio program. And you know, you're a bit of a renaissance man. You got so many things going on. Obviously that you know, you're busy, so it's hard to get you on, but you're running all of the tech stuff, companies, your Bomb Thrower newsletter, Bitcoin Capitalist. And regarding your bio and your projects, is there anything else for us to know? Anything I missed?
Oh, geez. No, you pretty well hit all of the major points. There's I'm thinking of getting the band back together. So that'll be, you know, another time suck if I do it. But I've just been feeling the urge more and more recently since the election in particular. I just want to say to hell with it and just start a punk rock band again.
Yeah, that's right. And people go to your website and your bio. You guys had a few albums, so you're also a punk rocker. Hey, why not? You know, why not? And there's so many things I want to touch on. And again, if people haven't subscribed at least to your free Bomb Thrower newsletter, they should. You write. You don't write as often, but when you write, it's a lot of quality and a lot to digest. And there are some amazing pieces there. But maybe to start, just to get your pulse on how you see where we're at with the new world order, globalism, Great Reset, you know, the Omnivore. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. My read on all that is a little counterintuitive or sort of contrarian, I would say, because, you know, everything is proceeding along the lines that I won't say the word predicted, but just, in the Crypto Capitalist Manifesto, I kind of said, I think this is the way things are headed. And these are the incentives and the impulses that are driving it in this direction. And I haven't been surprised by anything that's happened since then, other than the speed at which it's happening. So it's, you know, things that I talked about in my mind, like the weaponization of the banking system, I thought was like a 5 to 20 year or like a 10 to 20 year thing. And then it happened within 2 years right here in Canada, in my own country, with the government seizing bank accounts for wrongthink. So all of that's playing out faster than I thought. But the contrarian side of it is I really believe that this is late stage globalism, the kind of last gasp of centralization and nation states as we know them. It seems like we're headed into this Orwellian dictatorial, you know, tyrannical regime. And I wrote about this in a couple of different pieces over the years. There have been numerous times in history when it appeared as if the governing regime was that it's all powerful and only going to consolidate power even further when they sort of turn to dust, almost anticlimactically. And I think we're headed for that everywhere across the world, because I think we've run out of runway on these things that we've been kicking the can for decades, really, like since the beginning of the fiat money era. And that's sort of the base driver of it is fiat money, the debt, the out of control debt, you know, Ponzi that can never be repaid. And COVID really was a kind of blow off top for tyranny, I think, globally. The other thing I'll say about it, I know I've been kind of going on a bit, but I also tend to eschew these unified global they conspiracies of everything is controlled by a bunch of shadowy figures in a star chamber somewhere that decide everything from who's going to win the Super Bowl to where the color revolution is going to happen next. I have never been able to find that believable. Yes, there are people with outsized power and outsized influence, and a lot of times their interests overlap and coalesce, and so they scratch each other's back, and you see sort of factions or different tribes, and they seem to move in a peloton, which happened during COVID. Like, everyone just kind of came out of a Davos meeting chanting Build Back Better like zombies, and it was hard not to think that this was some global coordinated all shadowy cabal. But I really believe there's nobody in control. There's no single entity in control. There will never be a one world government because there are too many megalomaniacs in the world to accede to a one world government. And we live in a largely out of control world. That's my mantra. And I think the driving force behind everything we see today is actually the accelerating speed of technological change, which was first written about, that I'm aware of, by Alvin and Heidi Toffler back in 1970 with the release of Future Shock. And then they put out several books, about one per decade after that. But I think that is the driving force for everything we see today, all the chaos, all the high weirdness and everything like that. It's all the accelerating pace of change combined with, we're in kind of a global crack-up boom in the Austrian sense, and everything's out of control. Nobody's governing it. Nobody's steering it. It's just, we're like on a crazy roller coaster.
Before going further on the tech, you mentioned nation states, and I want to ask you, because you've been writing about this, you've also got your Bomb Thrower TV, where you conduct interviews with great guests, and you guys touched on Canada not long ago. And so there's all this talk of separation, U.S. annexing Canada, Canadian provinces separating. You've got the idea of the North American Technate, which has been around for a century, or the North American Union. I've interviewed the late Dr. Robert Pastor, who discussed that. And then, you know, we've got these riots in L.A. now. I mean, even in Mexico, I was surprised to learn recently that in Mexico, there's some feelings of some Mexican states seceding, that not very strong or as advanced as in the U.S. or Canada. But what are your thoughts when it comes to Canada, with Mark Carney now there running the program, and all this talk of separation of provinces?
Yeah, where to start there? So, I mean, part of it all just connects more of those dots where I think nation states, as we know them, are sort of industrial era constructs. You know, they came out of the Westphalian order, if I'm pronouncing that right. And, you know, that was a more linear, hierarchical, comprehensible world. And with the advent of computer networks and technology and decentralized communications, like, all of that has changed. And so the governing units will become a lot more amorphous and mercurial. They'll resemble networks themselves. I'm not saying nation states are going to go away, just that they're going to have to cede some of their gravitas to these new emerging structures. And some of them, we don't even have names for them yet, you know? And yet they are elbowing their way onto the geopolitical stage. And so what we see happening in Canada is just a symptom of that. You know, we've been grappling with Quebec separation for as long as I can remember. You know, I was born in the late 60s. There was at least two referendums when I was a kid. They just voted for remaining in Canada by a smidge, like 51 or 52% either time. Kind of cooled down, but Quebec has always sort of been a thing unto themselves. They've asserted that, they defend it rigorously, and now we're seeing that again post-election, that they are throwing their weight around for their sort of provincial sovereignty. I mean, I was in England a couple of weeks ago, and there's a Quebec embassy there that's been there since 1962. They have their own embassy in London, England, which is, you know, kind of blew me away. Texas used to have their own embassy as well, but they were an independent country at the time. So now we have Alberta, which is a completely understandable dynamic because they've really been treated like the toe jam of the country for decades, even though it's Alberta oil that pays for everything in this country. And if you look at the graph of transfer payments, the provinces that get it, the provinces that pay it, like, it's really hard to be an Albertan. And I'm not in Alberta, I'm in Ontario. I can see how it'd be really hard to be an Albertan and not feel like you're being taken for granted and frankly demonized, right, by Ottawa, and just being expected to take it. It's very insular and imperious behavior coming out of Ottawa and the Laurentian elites. And, you know, this is all very predictable decline and fall trajectories. So Alberta will leave if things stay on their current trajectory. I would like them to stay. I would like the band to stay together, as I've frequently remarked. But that's my sentimentality. The world we live in, I think the dynamics and the incentives are such that, you know, eventually there'll be a Wexit. Quebec will probably take their cue and leave. Some of the chunks of Canada will end up either economically or tacitly aligned or assimilated by the U.S. You know, you've had, we talked about him offline, Matthew Arrett, on your show multiple times, and I've just started reading his books. And the hidden history of Canada from the early days is really kind of mind-boggling. Like, had we been left to our own devices, there was a good shot we would have just gone in with the 13 colonies. You know, at the time of the Declaration of Independence, we would have, you know, would have been 15 colonies maybe. But there was a lot of, you know, Rhodes and Milner roundtable machinations in the background that kept us positioned more as a bulwark against the rise of America instead of, you know, a couple more states that would have been part of it. And that's been kind of an eye opener, reading those books and sort of going down that forbidden rabbit hole of history.
Yeah, I've had Matt long ago on the podcast, and he was my first guest on my first show on TNT Radio back in when I started in 2022.
Oh, interesting.
And I, you know, just to go further on that, you know, and sometimes with my guest and I on Geopolitics and Empire, we discuss these things, and it's not always necessarily what we want to happen or don't want to happen. Kind of as you're doing this analysis, it's just kind of like, we're just looking at how things are actually developing. And I had a guest on a few months back, Sterling Lujan, and he's talking about network states or cyber states. And I think that's kind of what you're alluding to, where the nation state will remain, at least its shell. Like, you'll still sort of, there'll be this organism of nation state, but it'll be swallowed up, where more functions will be given to supranational regional structures, technological structures. So just any further, you know, we're seeing in Honduras now these private companies come in creating these sort of like private city states, and that's happening all over the place. Balaji, right? So is that sort of what you're alluding to?
Yes, exactly. And I used to have a podcast going. We still have the Axis of Easy weekly tech digest, but we used to do a more discussion-oriented salon with Charles Hugh Smith and another Canadian, Jesse Hirsch. And we used to talk about that a lot. And we kicked around, you know, network state as a concept. And then Balaji, he messaged me on Twitter once saying like, hey, you know, I came up with the network state idea. And I'm like, okay, congratulations, you know, more power to you. But, you know, that's that, you know, those kinds of ideas, they kind of spontaneously erupt all over the world as their time comes. And the analogy I use all the time is snow crash. If you've ever read the Neal Stephenson book, where, you know, you have countries, networks, corporations, organized crime, and they all sort of have this kind of almost nation state or geopolitical status unto themselves. And they all have to compete with each other and jockey around these different sort of surfaces, you know, tension surfaces of where does that conflict?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much where we are headed. And I guess to ask you, you know, because you're the guy when it comes to cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, and you know, and some of the things that we're talking about, you know, you and I don't necessarily see eye to eye, and you know, I don't know, you know, I could be wrong on some things, but you know, where I like to get your take, your download on everything, but if you could sort of help us make sense of the environment when it comes to Bitcoin, there's all this talk of Bitcoin strategic reserves. I feel like something big is brewing that the U.S. government is working on. All this talk of stable coins, CBDCs. You also just tweeted, it was fascinating. I mean, we're seeing this trend now expand. There's something is going on where in Bolivia, on grocery store shelves, they're now pricing items in Tether, U.S. Stable coins. So it's like, there's a clear trend here. And so could you sort of help us make make sense of what's going on?
So I wouldn't call myself a Bitcoin maxi. I consider myself a Bitcoin primacy. Like, I think, you know, Bitcoin is a category of one, and will remain so for the foreseeable future. And then cryptos are everything else. Most of them are garbage. Some of them have a reason to exist. Some of them may come into existence in the future for a good reason. But I look at those mainly as application stacks that are using this new decentralized architecture, whereas Bitcoin is the only, I'll qualify that statement, but Bitcoin is the monetary regime change. This is the hard asset that is decentralized and unconfiscatable. That's the big one, right? And we've seen various events over the past few years that actually like drove the point home for Bitcoin. Stable coins, you know, it's funny, the entire time before Bitcoin became mainstream, which I think it's in the process of becoming now, but before that point, when everybody was saying like, they will never allow Bitcoin, they will shut down Bitcoin, they will never allow it to compete with their currencies. And of course, there was no stopping it. But I thought exactly the same thing about stable coins. Like, I couldn't understand, like, those were so much more of a blatant incursion on the sovereignty of the dollar or the fiat currency that I thought there's no way they're going to keep going with this. Like, Tether is going to get shut down, Circle, because they were, they just went public, but they were trying to go public much sooner. So they were already filing disclosures with the SEC that were far more granular than anything Tether has ever put out. So I could see why they could sort of thread the needle of regulations. But I just really thought this is almost literally counterfeiting, right? Except, yeah, it's like you're counterfeiting, you're printing your own money, but you're saying, you know, but for every dollar I print on the laser copier, I'm going to have a real dollar in the drawer here. So that's going to make it all legal. And it's happened. And I think that's a tacit admission by governments, the US government in particular, is we all knew the end of US dollar hegemony was coming, right? The dollar was just being inflated into irrelevance. And this is what we were going to have to deal with. There's this recognition that something had to be done to extend the lifespan of the dollar. And I think they looked at stable coins to say, okay, that's it. Like, this is what we're going to use to create the rails for central bank digital currencies and for digital dollars and to sort of keep this thing relevant for another few decades. Because otherwise, we face a real prospect of de-dollarization and a crisis that would bring about. I know Trump campaigned on no CBDCs on his watch, but I still think when you look at what's happening with surveillance like Palantir, when you look at what's happening with digital ID, I mean, even when you look at some of the things the Treasury is doing, I think a CBDC-like vehicle is inevitable ever anywhere. And in the States, maybe it's not the Fed that does it. Maybe it's the Treasury, and then it's not a CBDC. It's a TBDC, and, you know, it's this equivalent of crossing your fingers behind your back when you say it. But I think these things are inevitable. I think that Bitcoin is the anti-CBDC, right? That said, there's a whole financialization process that is now happening to Bitcoin, and some people are happy with it, and some people are very skeptical of it. And I just look at it as an inevitability. If Bitcoin was to succeed, then this is what was going to happen. But at the end of the day, as long as anyone can own Bitcoin and self-custody it, that is still your bedrock for financial independence in the future, right? You got to do a few other things too. I mean, you do a lot of this, the plan B, the multiple passports and that sort of thing. But at the bottom of that stack, you have to own some Bitcoin and you have to own it in self-custody. And you have to basically have it outside of that global digital, you know, algorithmic ghetto, as you call it. Because there's going to be, you know, there's going to be a monetary regime change. There's going to be a future monetary system. I don't deem to tell you what that's going to be or what it's going to look like, but I think there's going to be gold as a component. I think there's going to be Bitcoin as a component. There's going to be a basket of currencies as a component because they have to, you know, they have to regain faith in the dollar, and they also have to be able to create some mechanism for fiat derivatives in there because they have this belief that if you can't expand the monetary system at will, then the economy is going to collapse. So there's going to be these rehypothecated derivative financialized instruments that are sort of Bitcoin in name, what Ben Hunt calls like Bitcoin TM, but they won't be real Bitcoin. And there's going to be a whole generation of people walking around with like Satoshi Nakamoto t-shirts that have never had their own UTXO in their own possession or under their control.
It's kind of like the kids who wear the Nirvana shirts, you know, who are born long after Nirvana existed. Just to go on that further point, I remember from our past conversation on TNT, you talked about how we'll get this CBDC. I like how you said TBDC. I call it PBDC, private bank digital currency. So we'll get that sort of dystopian algorithm ghetto. But then you believe that we'll have other options parallel to it, like Bitcoin and other things. I'm as of now, I'm pretty sort of doom-pilled when it comes to the algorithm ghetto, where I feel like it's going to make life extremely difficult. How far do you think we'll go down that road of dystopia, you know, in North America or globally?
For me, the big question is, will the global monetary system hold together long enough to roll out the algorithmic ghetto? That has always been the question in my mind. The directionality is clear, right? Especially since COVID, we see the direction they want to go. I think, especially with AI, you know, this explosion in AI. Did I just freeze up on you, or can you still hear me okay?
I can see, yeah, you're back now, yeah.
Okay. So there's going to be mass unemployment. There's going to be UBI. It doesn't matter whether you and I think UBI is sustainable or fair or whatever. There's going to be UBI, or it's going to be Mad Max. Like, those are the two options. So there'll be UBI. There will be, you know, CBDCs will be the rails for UBI. They might not be called CBDCs. And then my personal pet theory is those will be based on like carbon personal carbon footprint quotas, right? So they're going to say it's for the environment, and you've had too much red meat this month, so you have to eat soy patties and cricket burgers instead. And that's going to be for everybody who has no independent source of wealth or assets. So the antidote to that is you have to have Bitcoin. You have to own assets. You have to own income producing businesses, things like that. But how far will it get into this CBDC land, 15-minute cities? I mean, I view the narrative around those with a little bit of skepticism, but the impetus is there, right? The dynamic, the directionality is clear. They want you to not own a car. I'm using the word they, even though I hate the word they. You're okay, so car ownership disincentivized, single family homes disincentivized, eating red meat disincentivized. Okay, so all of those things are being disincentivized out of some, you know, ostensibly climate driven narrative, but I say it's really just a guise for forced austerity because we've blown up a debt bubble that's so big we can never deflate it. How bad does it get? If the system holds together, it gets really bad. You know, it gets worse before it gets better. If the system doesn't hold together, if it blows apart, the whole thing cracks up, then I have no idea. Like, I really don't know then. I have no predictions other than nobody knows what's going to happen. There's probably going to be a lot of balkanization. There's going to be all these splinterings. You're going to have like a warlord on the streets of Toronto, and you're going to, you know, it's just going to be like straight cyberpunk William Gibson, Neal Stephenson novels, graphic novels.
Yeah. And like I say, it's hard for anyone to know exactly how that's all going to play out. You touched on, I was going to read this quote from your most recent piece, I think published just a day or two ago, where you say, quote, "I wish I had better news than this, because the world we're headed into, while technologically fantastic, will also be economically bleak for too many people. It's not fair. It's not egalitarian. There's no stopping it short of a Tower of Babel 2.0 type event, which will be a total buzzkill in even less preferable ways. I've called this scenario the Great Bifurcation, where the world's middle class disintegrates and we head into a hellscape of mind-boggling wealth disparity." And I think that's clearly the trend globally. You're seeing it everywhere, where the middle class is eroding, and we're going back to, you know, neo-feudalism in the sense. Any thought on the Bitcoin price? Does it keep going up forever? Does it drop? I mean, you're seeing all these people come out of the woodwork. That senator, I always forget her last name, Lumens or whatever, Kathy Wood, I bookmarked her interview she just gave for further viewing. She says it's going to 10x going forward in the next few decades. Do you just have any thought on, in this environment, if Bitcoin becomes part of the system, what happens to its price? Will it serve the function of, say, gold or silver, where it will preserve your purchasing power?
Yeah, 100%. And I still think it's quite early in that process, because what I do, I don't really, I mean, yes, I pay attention to the individual Bitcoin price. Like, you can't not do that. But I don't gauge whether it's expensive or inexpensive looking at the unit price of a of a price of Bitcoin. I look at the total market cap of Bitcoin, and I always compare it to the total market cap of bonds, because to me, bonds are the scaffolding of this dying system that can't sustain itself, and it's held together with spit and twist ties, and it's like papered over with all of these layers of rehypothecated debt. And those debt are denominated in units called, you know, denominated in wrappers called bonds, right? And someday that entire edifice is going to undergo a transformation and an exodus and a probably a disorderly phase transition. And so how big is that pile? Like, that pile right now is anywhere between $180 to $300 trillion, right? Nominally, like, we're measuring it in these dollars, which are eroding to nothing anyway. Gold, you know, I used to say it's 10 trillion. It's practically doubled. So gold's at 20 trillion now. So that's still a tiny, tiny sliver of this big pile of garbage, you know, dead money walking over here. They used to call bonds, especially sovereign bonds, used to be like risk-free return. And now it's called return-free risk, right? Because, you know, they're just going down the tubes. Silver is not even $1 trillion yet, I don't think. I know it's been on a tear lately. I don't know if it's, is it over? Anyway, so it's not huge. Bitcoin has passed silver. Bitcoin is now $2.2 trillion US, compared to, call it, 200 trillion in bonds. It's like 1% of the bond market. So if only 10% of the bond market leaves, right? $20 trillion leaves the bond market. And if only 10% of that goes into Bitcoin, so 10% of 10% coming into Bitcoin, like, doubles the market cap from 2 to 4 trillion. And, you know, I used to leave it at that. And I think in the Crypto Capitalist Manifesto, there's these tables that sort of show, like, this kind of a bond exodus leads to this price and the Bitcoin price. And then had a retired banker from one of the Canadian big fours mail me after the Crypto Capitalist Manifesto came out. He said, you're actually wrong about that because you didn't account for the size of the Bitcoin float. Now, is the price of Bit, like, because all available Bitcoin, whatever we're at now, 17, 18 million Bitcoin that are out there, they're not all available for sale at the same time. Yes, the higher the price goes, the more of them become available, but it's still, you know, a fraction of that. It's, so if an extra $2 trillion came into the Bitcoin market, you wouldn't just divide it into 21 million, you divide it into, like, whatever, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million, however big the tradable float is. So it would reprice in a major, major, major way. And it's almost ludicrous to speculate what that would be. So whenever I hear people say, oh, Bitcoin's like $110,000 today, that's like crazy, it's lunacy, it's backed by nothing, it's not anything. It's like, you're not getting it, okay? The point is, right, the world has kind of gone in this direction. It's been decided. There are ETFs, there are strategic reserves, there are companies building hundreds of billions of dollars worth of infrastructure to support it. Like, it's done. The decision has been made. This is not going to be unwound, right? Or walked back, or like, oh no, we've decided to go in a different direction and we're going to go with Beanie Babies instead. Like, that's just not going to happen. So at what point does that equilibrium set in of capital and wealth and purchasing power draining out of the bond pile and into the gold pile, the silver pile, the real estate pile, the private equity pile, and the Bitcoin pile, because that's where it is all going to go.
Yeah, that conclusion you just made, I'm seeing that now. I mean, Uber CEO just came out this week saying they're going to be integrating Bitcoin. You're seeing that all over the place. Any thought on the comment of the Coinbase CEO who came out and said that Bitcoin will replace the US dollar as world reserve currency?
It's, you know, that's a pretty aggressive opinion. I've never And so I've been surprised all along the way, by the way, because I first came out saying Bitcoin will never become an officially sanctioned like tier one asset. Like it's just not going to happen. The central bankers will not allow it. And it is a tier one asset now. Like there's already Basel 2 or 3 or whatever those guidelines are called. There are Basel guidelines for the banking system to say like this is how you have to collateralize and reserve crypto assets, including Bitcoin. There are ETFs, there are national strategic reserves. So that had already exceeded what I thought was going to happen in the early days. I always thought of Bitcoin, and I was turned out to be wrong, but I always thought of it as Notgeld, which is the German phrase that came into being during the Weimar hyperinflation, which means emergency money, right? I thought Bitcoin was a global emergency money that is emerging during this slow rolling global hyperinflation. And every hyperinflation has a Notgeld, right? In Germany, cities started printing individual scrip. In Zimbabwe, it was prepaid phone cards and gas cards. Venezuela, they're using flakes of gold. Bitcoin was a global Notgeld. And then, you know, things changed. You've probably heard me talk about it. The U.S. government seizing foreign reserves of two other nation states, regardless of who they were or what they did. That rung a bell. Then the Canadian government seizing bank accounts, that rang a bell. And suddenly you have institutional capital saying, we want access to this asset. And that's what sort of made it, brought it inside the system. So it's already kind of exceeded my previous expectations. Now, will it become the global reserve currency? I still have a hard time seeing that because of the deflationary nature of it, right? I know, like there are books, entire books written. One's called Paper Money Collapse by Detlev Schlichter. He put that out in 2012, I think. He wrote a follow-up, a second edition, which I think covers Bitcoin, but I've never read the second edition. And he lays out very meticulously like how global economies, even an expanding global economy, can run on a deflationary currency, right? It's just prices go down, right? And people, you talk to a guy like Paul Krugman, he tells you like you're taking crazy pills. You can't live in a world where prices go down. But we're used to seeing our purchasing power go down for infinity, right? You see that famous chart of the US dollar and it like where it was in 1913 and where it is today. And we're just kind of used to that. So would it be any harder to make the cognitive shift to flip that graph so that you've got like one Satoshi on this end and you just follow its purchasing power and it just keeps going up forever? Right. Like it's the same dynamic going in the opposite direction. And it's a much more benign one when you think about it, because how crazy is that when your cost of living is going down and the rewards of your labor is going up? Like what kind of a world would that give us? A very different one. So whether we go all the way there, I don't know. There's Nick Battia's original book, Layered Money, which sort of made that case that there would be this whole financial system on top of a layer of Bitcoin. His new book just came out. I haven't read that one yet either. Does it get to that point? I've been wrong before, maybe, but where I think, you know, what I have an easier time wrapping my head around is a kind of like some sort of monetary reset where Bitcoin is a piece of the new system, not the entire new system.
Yeah. I also find it hard to see how when people like the Coinbase CEO, his name,
Brian Armstrong,
right. When he says the Bitcoin becomes a new world reserve, it's hard to see how that would happen. Maybe it will, but it's at this point it's hard to see how that would happen. Let me ask you also real quick, because you write on this about the singularity. You say it's already happened, transhumanism. You're sometimes a guest on Bannon's War Room. Joe Allen is there. I've had him on the podcast. I've hung out with Joe. Cool guy. I think he slightly disagrees with you. And you've got some fascinating pieces. And what I like, you mentioned writers and books that I've never heard of, as well as concepts. And so just your thoughts, what we've been talking about so far, I feel like the next step is this transhumanism singularity stuff. Just what are your thoughts? What's important here? What are you thinking about when it comes to singularity and transhumanism?
Yeah, Joe Allen doesn't sort of disagree with me. He vehemently disagrees with me on this point. But my point when I wrote that article, The Singularity Has Already Happened, was that we crossed a tipping point once AI and LLMs became capable of writing code. And then from there, when we started bolting on agentic AI, which is just happening now, now you have autonomous agentic AIs that are capable of writing code that can write more code. So that this has started an iterative feedback loop. And in my mind, that's kind of singularity material. It wasn't like an eschatological event. I can't pronounce that word, where suddenly Skynet wakes up and the world changes instantly. That may still be in the future. And maybe that's the context where Joe and Steve Bannon mean, because they talk about, molecular assemblers and self-modifying code, and they've got a point there. And that's why actually in this last article, I created a neologism. I created a new word, right? Tachyosis, which maybe fits better than singularity, whereas tachyosis is this compounding process of speeding up, right, in multiple different directions. Because I was just like, acceleration doesn't cover it, right? If acceleration is happening across multiple different dimensions and they are all accelerating, you've got to come up with another word for it, right? Because that's what's happening now. And it's happening like so fast. And I don't believe AI is self-aware. I don't believe it will ever be self-aware. I don't believe that it has consciousness. But what it is an absolute revolutionary breakthrough in natural language processing. That's good news for humans, but it's also bad news if you can't wrap your head around it fast enough. The good news is that you can translate your own thoughts into real-world results more accessibly, it's more doable than ever before in history, right? It's lightning in a bottle for every human being on Earth, and that's going to be chaotic.
And just further, any thought on sort of the man merging with machine? We've seen actors on the scene such as Cobra Commander Klaus Schwab. Elon Musk with all these different sorts of brain chips, brain computer interfaces, Neuralinks and all that. Do you think that's something that will be commonplace, where humans will be biohacking themselves and upgrading themselves, sort of merging with machine?
I think there will be a segment of people who go in that direction. Absolutely. For sure. That's another area that I've been thinking about a lot that I haven't really written about very much yet. I even had a word for it, which I forget what it is, but it's like the transhumanists are completely wrong about, I think, the directionality of this, like trying to just reduce themselves to computers and thinking of themselves in terms of just software that they can upload into the cloud. I think what's really happening in an evolutionary sense, in an accelerating evolutionary sense, is people, there's biohacking of sort of like using, experimental therapies and drugs and supplements. And I really think we're on the cusp of like a mega lifespan explosion, a second one, because we're already living through one. You know, I told Steve Bannon that the first time I was ever on his show. I said, you know, Steve, we're already living in the era of radical life extension, right? Because not long ago, the average lifespan was like 35 was old, and most people died before they were 11 of diarrhea, right? So that's kind of the bulk of humanity until not that long ago. So now what we have is radical life extension, and then we're going to do it again, and then we're going to do it again after that. We're never going to be immortal because people just, they say it without really understanding what infinity really means, right? But, you know, we could definitely get to a Methuselah stage for those who can afford it, right? And I think I hinted on it a bit in the last article that, like, that I don't like to call it transhumanism, but that sort of evolution is really mental and conscious. If you've ever heard of Gene Gebser, who wrote a book called The Ever-Present Origin, he was German. I think he wrote it in 1950. It never got translated into English until 1970 or something like that. So, I mean, he basically maps the evolution of human consciousness from like hunter-gatherer days when we couldn't even differentiate our own minds from nature. Like, we didn't walk around thinking, I'm hungry, or, you know what I mean? Because we couldn't even think of ourselves as a separateness from what was going on in the world around us. We all just, our minds just blended in with our experience, and there was no differentiation. And from there, you know, things just kind of went into mythic and, you know, built on top of that. That's, you know, self-awareness came into it, and separateness came into it, and identity came into it. And those ideas have been built on by other thinkers over the years. You know, Carl Jung came up and said, okay, now there's still this base layer underneath of the collective subconscious, but we have these like eyes on top of it, these self-aware conscious constructs. And I think we're going to evolve again mentally into something that can wrap our heads around what's going on around us so fast. And there's, you know, all of our senses really just apprehend a tiny sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum. And so there's so much more going on. We're probably going to train ourselves to apprehend more of it. That's what I think happens in the transhumanistic sense. But like, you know, stapling a chip into your brain and uploading yourself into like Oracle. Yeah, people are going to try it. You know, good luck. I don't see it working, really.
Yeah, me either. I'm gonna personally stay organic. We've covered a lot. Is there an issue that I haven't brought up that you think is important that you think about?
You know, I really think that now is the time. Like, for one thing, it looks bleak, but I really do think that there is this impelling drive to overall progress, you know, amongst everyone. I don't mean that in a progressivist sense, like, you know, purple hair and pronouns. I just mean it like people are kind of hardwired to try to be better and to attain more. And I think that's a good thing. And, you know, but we're in this period where radical self-reliance is being thrust upon you more so than ever before in this world. And so you have to take care of yourself. You have to stay healthy. You have to work out. You have to eat well. And you have to connect with other people who are sort of not drinking the Kool-Aid of whatever resident algorithmic ghetto they happen to reside in. When you see everyone, when you see like 80, 70% of the people in your community sort of chanting the same mantra, you probably want to be outside of that sort of construct, maybe even taking the opposite side of it. And yeah. Try not to follow the herd and get with like-minded people in a tribe.
I think that's a really good point. As I've been tending to stay away from people who just keep doubling down on the insanity that insane narratives that are given to us, because it's dangerous. You know, the system, with the event of the 2020s, you know, they often try to kill us. And so it's like, this person's not helping me survive. And any further thought, you alluded to this, but ways people can further protect themselves or do well, I guess, from your mind, you know, buy some Bitcoin. And as you said, no one's coming to help us. So we're it's survival mode, becoming self-reliant and starting businesses, finding new ways of building income. Just any further thought on how people can survive or thrive?
Yeah, it's the sovereign individual playbook, really. And so, I mean, it's been a long time since I read that book, and that book was written in the 90s. So, it's the holy writ of the Bitcoin space. And interestingly enough, you know what? I won't reveal too much about it because I do have an announcement coming about what's going on with the newsletter and that kind of thing. But I may be involved in a project that wants to take a crack at sort of updating that sort of framework. And I guess maybe a little bit of a plug. I don't really know what I'm doing with this yet, but I am starting, I guess, a Canadian, I call it a prepper network, but it's more of just like right now, it's sort of like a sanity coping mechanism called ready.ca. And there's nothing there right now other than a mailing list to opt into. And it's a tribe, you know, we're going to create a thing for politically homeless Canadians that are kind of like beyond politics now. And it's not just like a lot of Americans have already signed up for it. Everyone is welcome. It's just here I am in Canada. So this is where I started it. And so after the election, I thought if the Liberals get voted out, there's no need for it. And I can just keep on working on all my other projects. And if somehow, like against the odds, the Liberals actually pull this election out, then there will be a real need for it. And there they go. They won it incredibly. I burnt out for a while. I didn't want to do anything. But now I'm starting to see, like, you know what? We kind of need this, if only for a coping mechanism, right? And just mutual support group self-therapy. But I'm starting that and slowly rolling that up, and we'll see where that goes.
It's funny, you're the third person in the recent months to discuss, to mention sovereign individual, and I'm on the podcast, and I've got it on my desktop, and I haven't read it yet. So that's my summer reading. All of your links are in the description if you want to just remind us again your best services, projects, where people should go.
Yeah, sure. My day job is running easydns.com, domain names, web hosts. We just started a new email product with enhanced spam and virus filtering and stuff like that. We have a coupon code for you. Is it geopolitics?
It's geopolitics, or they can use the link on the website. And
so that gets you a discount there. Bombthrower.com, get on the mailing list. You get a copy of the Crypto Capitalist Manifesto, and you're supposed to get a copy of the CBDC Survival Guide when I finally get that finished. It's like 80% of the way done, but it's kind of stalled because I don't know how to handle the American side of it now that Trump is in and he's saying no CBDCs, but they're kind of happening anyway. So I'm still trying to wrap my head around that part. And then ready.ca is that new project, which is just really starting to get off the ground now. So,
all right, very cool. Yeah, you know, I jumped my domain. It's funny, you know, the past few years of all this censorship dystopia. I was using a standard run of the mill hosting the domain hosting service, and then I would jump to Epic, Rob Monster.
Yeah,
and then he just, I don't know what would happen. Epic completely collapsed.
Yeah, they kind of imploded. And it's been taken over by Christopher Ambler, who is actually a a pioneer in the domain name space. He's been around longer than I have, and he was supposed to, bit of internet lore here. He was originally given the green light by John Postel, the guy who invented the whole naming system, or ran it. He was given the green light to launch .web, like way back before ICANN was even a thing. And then it never happened, and ICANN came into power, and they kind of screwed him one way or another, or not, I don't know. It just never happened. And then I was slightly surprised to find out that he is the new sort of principal behind Epic, and Rob is gone. I don't know on what terms, but he's completely out, I think.
And just judging from some of their comments online, they seem to have done a 180, gone a bit slightly more woke, and then their services sort of broke, what's the word, they sort of disintegrated and broke apart. And that's when I said I was having issues with my services, and I'm like, I need a place to put my domain. And I'm like, Mark, I trust Mark, we're going with EasyDNS. And so Geopolitics and Empire is at the EasyDNS domain. So so far so good. And you know, and it's great, because I think trust is the currency. So given the work that you do, you're pro freedom. And so I want to go with some. That's why I went to Epic, because initially I trusted Rob. He said he was a Christian. He was defending liberty. And then I don't know what happened. So maybe it was incompetence. I don't know.
Rob's problem, I might get myself in trouble for saying this. So Rob's problem was he didn't thread the needle as well as we thread the needle. Right. And we've been criticized for this. Like Stormfront asked to come on EasyDNS, and we said no. Right. Had nothing really to do with free speech or no free speech. It was just from a business risk perspective. It's like, we're not going to spend $1 million fighting DOS attacks over the next 2 years for a $15 domain transfer from Stormfront. Like, that's not going to happen. It makes absolutely no business sense. Rob would basically take anybody on, and he'd be really vocal about the worst of the worst of them. And so he just he really tainted his own reputation. And so, yeah.
And as you say, it's a business decision. And if those Stormfront guys, I mean, at the end of the day, they can self-host, but they need someone to do the domains. But all right, well, it's always great getting an update from you, Mark. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I meant to ask you, sorry, I don't know if you want to wait till after we roll or what. How did you get like so penalized online? You're not Stormfront, you're not 8chan. Why is it when I type you into Google, I can barely, you've been de-indexed, right? Your PayPal's been nuked. Like, what did you do?
Right. I mean, that was, it's hard to, I figured out some things by putting two and two together, but effectively it began with, I think everything began with that Francis, was it 2020, Francis Boyle interview that went viral, pun intended, and that bothered somebody. And then so what happened then? That was January 2020. 2021, I got a Patreon nuked me. And it's funny because that they said, according to the WHO and CDC, so like that's the standard. And so I had to delete two interviews from the entire internet. Patreon told me to be reinstated on Patreon. But I'm like, first of all, that's against my principles. I'm not going to do that. And second of all, who's to say tomorrow you're not going to tell me, oh, delete 5 more interviews. Oh, delete 10 more interviews from Apple, Spotify, YouTube, my website, everything. I'm like, you guys are insane. And so it's like they're following CDC and WHO. So Patreon gone. And then 2022. That happened the same week that the Associated Press article came out and did a hit piece on Francis Boyle, and it mentioned Geopolitics and Empire, that interview, conspiracy super spreaders. And that article was written in conjunction with Atlantic Council, NATO's think tank.
Yeah.
So you can see what we're dealing with is this military intelligence, mainstream apparatus, disinformation. So I believe, it's I hit a certain threshold that got the attention of the military industrial complex, including Department of Homeland Security, NATO. And then April 2022, when Nina Yankowicz, if you remember her, the DHS rolled out Disinformation Governance Board. It's clear as day, the same week they rolled that out, me, Geopolitics Empire, personally, my PayPal account, Consortium News, Mint Press News, are banned from PayPal. And then I went to Nina's ex account. I'd never visited it ever before. Geopolitics and Empire was already blocked preemptively on Nina's ex account. So that's clear. And then Mike Benz, I'm sure you're familiar with, his Freedom Foundation have done reports, and he explains DHS and its sub-agency CISA. If you're committing thought crime, as you said earlier, that's considered disinformation, and you are a non-kinetic threat to the U.S. government, and by, I guess, speaking truth to power, malinformation, you are attacking the cyber infrastructure of the U.S. government. So like when I'm like, whoa. So effectively, I'm like one step removed from enemy of the state. And then that's, you know, that's PayPal. And then Google, at that same time, I noticed, like, if you type Geopolitics and Empire in Google search, it's I'm yeah. as my past guest Edwin Black would say, I've been zombied. I am a non-entity. So
yeah, it is strange. You haven't been delisted, because if you type like site.geopoliticsandempire.com, there's pages that come up. So that's like shows that you haven't been completely de-indexed, but if you type Geopolitics and Empire into Google, like, you don't come up, which is strange.
But all of that, you know, makes me proud. I had my past guest, Vietnam vet Bob Moriarty, who says it's a virtual purple heart, you know? So I pat myself, like, I'm still amazed though. Like, this happened. I'm just an average American citizen, high school teacher, university adjunct professor, pan my past life. And it's like, really? Like, Pentagon, really? You at my government? You're doing like, really?
I think what's happened to you, you got sort of included in some kind of meta list. So it was never against you specifically, but like some functionary somewhere said, like, here's a list of people, these are the disinformation dozen. You got swept up into that, and whoever is in that meta list is probably like stuck in some filters buried beneath dozens of layers of code that like people don't even know was there anymore.
I think that's just generally how the oligocracy technocracy works. That's how, yeah, I think most people get swept in. And my fear going forward is the, what's happening now? I call it the electronic thought crime authorization, electronic travel authorization in Europe now. Just last week, a whole bunch of European journalists, Alina Lipp, German journalist, she's an EU citizen, she's German, she lives in Russia. Okay. But they froze her bank accounts and she can't enter the EU. So we're at the point where now EU is banning EU citizens from entering. And like, I'm like, that potentially can happen to me. I don't think I've hit the threshold of Alina Lipp yet, but it's kind of like the fact that I have to be wondering about that is
I was a little relieved actually that England adopted the electronic travel visas, because we were going back to England. I was there once before, and each time I was like, am I going to run into a problem here? Because we had that sort of thing with the City of London Intellectual Property Crimes Unit, where we kind of made them look a little foolish because we didn't take them to an arbitrator, but a registrar that was listening to them. They sent out a bunch of takedowns to a bunch of registrars. We told them to go to hell. Another registrar took them down. The people there are trying to move their domains to us. We took it all the way up to a WIPO appeal and we won. So the domains got ordered, transferred to us. ICANN is since changing the policy, I think because of us, and it's been winding out for years. But I'm like, am I going to like get to England and they're going to tell me like you can't enter the country? So I was glad to have the electronic visa thing. Because I did it while I was here. And it's like, okay, you've been approved, so I can get on a plane and go there. But yeah, it's kind of a strange state of affairs to be walking around wondering what's going to happen in that sense.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. It's yeah, fun times, I guess.
Yeah. May you live in interesting times.